Welcome to New Books in Popular Music, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. In this episode, I talk with David Kirby about his book, Little Richard, The Birth of Rock and Roll, published in 2009 by Continuum. In Little Richard, Kirby uses Tutti Frutti, the song with the ever-memorable opening salvo of A Wop Bop A Loom Op A Lop Bam Boom, as the tipping point through which Richard Wayne Penniman goes from young, unknown wannabe star to Little Richard, international rock and roll sensation. Indeed, the book's five chapters are organized around this premise. Chapter 1 focuses on Richard's growing up years in Macon, Georgia, where, as black and gay, and through the sacred and secular influences of Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Louis Jordan, and Escarita, he develops a particular ability to outrage. In Chapter 2, Kirby presents early to mid-20th century Macon, everybody's other hometown, as a perfect example of what Greil Marcus calls the old, weird America. It was officially segregated, yet unofficially integrated, a place where, as in America's entire history, hucksters and entrepreneurs compete for riches and stardom, a place of drag queens and medicine shows. In short, Kirby presents Macon as a logical place to birth a sacredly queer African-American rock and roller. Chapter 3 focuses on the making of Tutti Frutti itself, showing well how any successful recording, let alone one of the greatest of all time, is a collaborative effort between artists, producers, label owners, studio personnel, songwriters, and more. All the important characters in the song's making are presented here. Chapter 4 looks at the impact Little Richard and Tutti Frutti had on the nascent teen rock and roll culture at large. The song's nonsensical lyrics paired with an insistent backbeat, formed where the deliberate meets the accidental, influenced many a teenager, black and white, straight and gay, to shake their booties. Finally, Chapter 5 examines Richard's place in American cultural history, his place as an artist of unmatched excellence in his sixth decade of performing, his place as the architect of rock and roll. David Kirby lives in Tallahassee, Florida, which is where I reached him for this interview. Hello, David, and welcome to New Books in Popular Music.
Matt, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great today.
Okay. Well, before we get directly to your book, why don't you tell us a little bit about your biography, where are you from, etc.?
Sure. I grew up on a farm in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I was born as World War II was winding down, and I went to LSU, Louisiana State University, which is a big football-loving kind of democratic place, and had a good broad public university education there. Then I went off to Johns Hopkins to graduate school, studied English, got a PhD at Hopkins, and decided that I would, since I'd lived in the South all my life and I thought of Baltimore as the South, I thought, well, I'm going to, you know, take a job some other part of the country and learn what they're doing. When I got job offers, there actually were academic jobs back in those days. I had five offers from Southern schools, so I came to Florida State University, and I've been here since 1969.
Wow, your only job, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Perfect.
Only job I've ever had.
Yeah. How did you come to write this book specifically, Little Richard?
Well, the poetry pays the bills at my house, Matt. My wife Barbara Hamby and I are both poets and both professors who teach at Florida State, and There's no such thing as a famous poet, but you can move from, shall we say, absolute obscurity to relative obscurity. So I worked my way up to that point, which meant that a lot of people on newspapers and magazines were asking me to write about poetry, and I did that and did that and did that over and over and over. And finally, I thought, well, you know, I need to shake it up a little bit here. So I guess about 10 years ago, I decided to reinvent myself as a music journalist. I'd always loved music and had a good fans knowledge of it, so I began to read more, and I began to ask some of the people who'd had me write about poetry to let me write about music. So I covered a lot of live concerts, so people like Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan, jazz great Marcus Roberts, Soul Reviver, Sharon Jones, and the Dap Kings, you know, just whoever came to town, really. And meanwhile, I was writing articles and reviews for the New York Times Book Review, the Chicago Tribune, Washington Post, and other places like that. And just found out that, you know, I knew more and more about music as I went along. So I said, well, time to time to bust a big one. So I got in touch with Continuum Press, and they have a beautiful little series called 33 and a Third. Do you know that series?
I do know that series. It covers specific records and albums, right?
Specific records and albums. And I wrote and I said, well, how about I do something on Here's Little Richard, 1957. And they said, no. And I said, what? Because, you know, part of their job, it seems to me, was to be pretty comprehensive, and especially talk about the beginnings of rock and roll. And they said, no, but, you know, we want to do a new series on the lives of the big masters of rock and roll. So I was one of the first ones. I and a guy named Joe Bonomo, who teaches in Illinois, wrote a book on Jerry Lee Lewis, and I got to write the book on Little Richard Pennyman.
And why did you choose Little Richard? Have you always been a fan? What's the reason?
Well, you know, I was a fan of, I've always been a fan of everybody, I guess. But there was one moment when I was a kid, I had a little green plastic Westinghouse radio with a wire antenna that you would sort of, you know, flop out the window. And I turned on the radio one morning in probably early 1956, so I would have been 11 years old. And the kind of songs you heard on the radio then were Patti Page singing "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?" How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do wish that dog were for sale. And, you know, I had pets, I had dogs. I thought that was okay. And another big one was Mitch Miller's "The Yellow Rose of Texas," which begins with this military drum beat, bum 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 bum, and then of course begins to sing, "Oh, the yellow rose of Texas is the only girl for me." And you know, I would sort of march around and think that's not bad either. One day I turned on my radio and a guy said, "Wah ba ba loo ma ba la bam boom," and I thought that is something different. That is, and you know, I wish I could say, well, this is going to change things, and you know, rubbed my chin and said something profound. But I said, you know, something's going on here. You know, goodbye, Patti Page. Goodbye, to the Yellow Rose of Texas. And I, you know, I switched my allegiances. Not, you know, already there were songs out by there were some Elvis songs out. His career hadn't really kicked in. Fats Domino and Chuck Berry were coming along, but you know, listen to that one song. Listen to "Tutti Frutti" by Little Richard. It hit me like a bolt of lightning. You know, as I say in the book, Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones says when you hear "Tutti Frutti," it's like flipping a light switch, and the world goes from black and white to Technicolor, which is, as analogies go, is pretty darn accurate.
So before we get any more to "Tutti Frutti," on page one, right off the bat, you write that he is the king of rock and roll, Little Richard. And I was doing my research, and I went back and looked at a lot of Little Richard YouTube. YouTube's such a wonderful thing, this age we live in. And he claims himself as the king of rock and roll sometimes.
Yeah.
So tell me, David, who is the real king of rock and roll?
Well, you know, Solomon Burke used to perform. He'd have a throne and a cape and a crown. And you know, James Brown was famous for having one of his helpers throw a cape over him on stage, and he was, you know, throw it off, and the guy would, you know, no, and anointed and make him the king again. So there's a lot of rock and roll royalty, but you know, I'm going to go with Richard because of that. You know, really the one song, as I say in my book, Isaiah Berlin, the English philosopher, said that the world is divided into foxes and hedgehogs, and that a fox is a clever creature who does, you know, many things. I think that describes most of us. You know, I teach and I write and, you know, do a lot of things around the community. And then that's what a fox is, and then a hedgehog is the creature that does one big thing, and you know, Little Richard's one big thing was Tutti Frutti, and then all the songs that, you know, came out in the next few years after that. I mean, he didn't have a big a kind of continuing career the way somebody like Neil Young does, but you know, he recorded all of those great songs, especially the one there's so many different versions of what the first rock and roll song is, and those are great fun arguments to have about, you know, which was the first real rock and roll record. But Tutti Frutti is the one that had the most impact. I mean, it, you know, very quickly it sold 500,000 copies. And you know what I like about YouTube as far as learning how things work. If you put Little Richard into YouTube, the first several hits that will come up will be of him playing, usually in movies, at teen parties, and he's got a suit on, and he's Little Richard. You know, he's screaming and he's jumping up and he's banging on the piano and flashing his teeth. But the interesting thing is, as far as that song and his career defining what he did in the musical world and in our world in general, is not him, but the other people in the movie. They're teenagers, and they get up and they dance, but they don't look like teenagers. They look like grown-ups. The guys are also wearing suits. They have padded shoulders. You know, they look like their dad's sports jackets. And the girls have crinoline skirts with you know, petticoats underneath them, so they'll flare out when they dance. And when the kids begin dancing, they're swing dancing, so they're doing dance. This is, you know, this is in the late 50s. They're doing some dances from the 30s and 40s. They're doing, you know, between the wars kinds of dances, and they're doing flash moves. You know, the girls are spinning. You know, the guys are reaching around behind their backs. You know, girls are sliding under their legs, and you know, a couple of back lifts. And they, you know, they're not doing the kinds of dances that kids were kind of doing in the 60s and 70s and forever after. So what you're looking at is the moment where, and this is, you know, a point, it's one of two points I wish I'd emphasize more in my book. It's the point where Little Richard Pennyman invents the teenager, because at this time, kids who were 16, 17, 18 years old were imitations of their parents. And you know, I was that age then, so I remember that, you know, you wanted to be like your mom and dad. You didn't have anything. You know, you had an allowance, and you know, you did chores around the house, but you wore clothes like your mom and dad. You aspired to be like your mom and dad. You damn sure didn't have an automobile. You know, if you got to drive a car, you would borrow your dad's car, and you know, you better bring it back, you know, clean and full of gas, or you wouldn't be able to borrow it again. And this is something it's fun to talk about with my students at Florida State, because they participate in a youth culture that they don't even ascribe that name to. You know, you don't need to call it anymore. It's just called being alive. But in, you know, in the periods before they came along, there was really just one culture. There were, you know, there were adults, and then young people who were called aspiring adults. They dressed like adults. They thought like adults. They acted like adults, and they hoped to be adults one day. And then, you know, just painting with a broad brush, you can say in the 60s, that's when the youth culture came along. That's when you begin to see protest movements. That's when Dylan and the folk movements came out, and Hendrix. That's when you know, clothing changed along with the music, and that's when kids began to say, "Look, I want to have my own car. I want to have my own room. I want to have my own clothes. I want to wear my hair funny. I'm not going to get a flat top like Dad had, and when he was on the flight deck of the aircraft carrier in World War II. You know, I want to." You know, grow sideburns, or I want to grow my hair down to my collar. You know, and the girls were saying, you know, I'm tired of dressing like mom. You know, if I want to go braless, I will. Or if I want to wear short shorts or bell-bottom pants, you know, I'll do that too. And of course, the marketers jumped right on it, and you have, you know, suddenly they had this huge aspiring demographic that had their own money, so they could design fashions for them, they could make music for them, they could change the looks of cars and make cheaper cars so the kids would want to drive them. And you know, Little Richard is, okay, again, he's not the only one who's responsible for that, but I think he's the prime mover.
So this is must be what you mean by Little Richard is a way of looking at the world.
I think so. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that, you know, Matt, that's one reason why I wanted to write this book, because my students didn't really know who he was. There's a Geico commercial, and there are a couple of other things on one of the kids' shows. He sings the Itsy Bitsy Spider, and they knew about that, but they saw him as, you know, a sort of clownish figure, which, of course, he's very happy to have been, and you know, he makes his living by touring and clowning these days. And, you know, they didn't really know who he was, so, you know, that was one thing. I, you know, and of course, while I had this passion that I hope is coming through in my voice today, I didn't have all the knowledge that I needed, so I thought, well, let me find out more about him, and then I'll, you know, tell them, and I'll go farther than that and write this book. When I get off with you, a guy is going to call me from Hobart and William Smith College today, because he's teaching my book in a class on the rock and roll to young people. So yeah, I'm glad I'm helping to get the word around. So that's one reason why I wanted to write the book, was to tell, you know, my students and other young people, and also, you know, people my age, you know, what I had found out about Little Richard, and you know, what the real deal is. Second reason why I wanted to write it was, these guys aren't getting any younger. Richard himself is going to be 80 on December 5th of this year, and the people who you know, support him, recording the sidemen, the other musicians, the engineers, producers, you know, and just contemporaries who knew him, you know, many of them are dead, and a lot of them were on their last legs. I went up to Macon, Georgia several times to talk to people there, and, you know, I talked to a couple of people in assisted living facilities, and a couple I just couldn't talk to because they were too far gone to converse anymore. But, you know, I realized, man, if I'm going to do this, I better get on it now.
First off, your book is centered around Tutti Frutti. Tell us about, chapter by chapter, briefly, you know, how is it organized around Tutti Frutti?
Sure. Well, you know, I go back to Richard's early life in Macon, because I wanted to know, you know, where the song came from, and that, you know, that's an interesting proposition, because I'm a poet, and you know, I write and publish a lot of poetry, and a lot you know, more general pieces, literary and cultural criticism about where art comes from, and sometimes you just can't say. You know, sometimes its origins are it doesn't mean they're mysterious. It just means that I can't tap them. I can't put my fingers on them. You know, where did that song, or where this poem, or, you know, a novel by Tolstoy or an opera by Verdi come from? And, you know, it's very easy to make up false causes and false historical reasons for why things happen. But, you know, I thought I would begin poking around in Macon. So, you know, the first couple of chapters are devoted just to a deep, deep entrance into life in that that wonderful little southern town. You know, a lot of the things that we think are of as timeless began in kind of backwaters, you know, small isolated places. I mean, the Italian Renaissance doesn't begin in London or Paris. It begins in, you know, a little city called Florence, where, you know, a bunch of people were sort of feeding and, you know, helping each other, feeding each other spiritually, emotionally, and artistically. And, you know, it didn't take me long to find out that Macon was that kind of place as well. You know, Otis Redding, you know, came out of there. The Allman Brothers went and recorded there. But, you know, even before these days, there was a very specific culture that has also disappeared, and our greatest cultural historian, Greil Marcus, calls it the old weird America, which he kind of takes back to Walt Whitman's time and describes as an America, you know, not of fluorescent lighting and computers and vitamin-enriched foods like the one that you and I are lucky enough to live in at the moment, but, you know, an America of con men and riverboats and sort of Johnny Appleseed figures roaming the world, and, you know, just kind of, you know, unpredictable strangeness. And, you know, Richard grew up in that kind of context. A couple of figures that I talk about in the book that I found were really interesting. One was named a guy named Doc Hudson, who ran a medicine show. Now, what a medicine show is a kind of traveling vaudeville show that peddles something that, well, I wouldn't say it doesn't work, but, you know, it probably didn't do all the things that it claimed to do. I mean, I don't know exactly what Doc Hudson's formula for his cure-all was, but a lot of these guys would get, you know, tap water, add a good dose of alcohol, because that always makes you feel better, and then something like peppermint oil to make the stuff smell good and taste good, and shake it all up, and say, you know, if you rubbed it on your head, it would cure baldness. If you were infertile as a woman and you drank it, you could get pregnant. If your horse was limping, you could rub it on his leg, and your horse would win the race next Sunday. And, you know, all sorts of exaggerated claims. But in a day without, you know, well, certainly without television or the Internet, and without very much radio or even electricity, these guys would travel from town to town and set up a show, and you know, get somebody or some bodies to come out and play the banjo or sing a dance and carry on, and then, as with a TV commercial, you know, the impresario himself, Doc Hudson, would come out and say, "Thank you all very much. I hope you enjoyed what you just saw here. Now let me show you what I've got here. This is this beautiful bottle of cure-all here. It's a dollar, but today I'm going to give it to you for the low price of 2 for 75 cents. And, you know, they'd have some shills in the audience, and they said, "Well, yeah, I used that stuff, and it, you know, cured my blindness in my right eye." And you know, they would just make out like bandits. And one of the regular entertainers from about age 10 up until he left Macon was Little Richard, because he was always a ham. He would sing and dance. And the people I talked to in Macon said that, you know, they remember, or their parents remember, being in class with him, you know, when he was in elementary school, and you know, the shenanigans he would get up to when the teacher would leave the room, or, you know, when the teacher was right there, and he was always getting in trouble. But, you know, he was an extrovert just from the womb, apparently. And so he would, you know, he would dance and sing for nothing, for a guy like Doc Hudson, just to show off and just get a round of applause. So that was, if I'm making Doc Hudson sound kind of like a, you know, a shady sort of shadowy figure of some kind, he was actually, you know, quite the you know, the pillar of the community compared to the other guy that I found out about, who was a character named Dr. Mobilio. And Dr. Mobilio was the town conjure man, which was a kind of male witch. And as I say, I grew up on a farm in the south of Louisiana, so I knew about those guys from the get-go. There was always somebody out in the woods who would cure your warts for you, just, you know, through a hypnotic spell or something like that. So Dr. Mobilio was a guy who had, you know, well, he had all these accoutrements with him, including a thing he called the Devil's Child, which was like a shrunken corpse of some kind that he would conjure with. And, you know, this was somebody that you know, Richard at least had a lot of contact with, you know, probably absorbed some lessons from as far as showmanship, and as far as, to use a word that neither he nor Dr. Mobilio nor Doc Hudson would use, to learn about marketing. That is, to learn how to sell yourself. You sell a product. You sell a product by selling yourself. If people like you, they will buy your insurance policy. Or if people like you, they will buy your peppermint flavored tap water. Or if people like you, they will buy your record, or believe that you can cure them by waving the devil's child over their head. So, you know, so there are all these characters. I'm just mentioning a couple of the ones I found out about. And, you know, the book really begins there. And then we go on into, you know, the development of Richard's career.
Mm-hmm. And tell your $88 story, please, David.
Okay, sure. The first time I went up to Macon, I wanted to get inside and have, you know, egress to a lot of things that I didn't. And I didn't have the book contract yet. You know, I was thinking about that. I was putting my proposal together. But I knew the travel editor at the Washington Post, and I said, will you commission a piece on this charming little city called Macon, Georgia? And they said, sure, you know, give us 800 words by such and such a date. So I went up there, and I'll tell you, Matt, when you're walking down the street in a little town, and you have a notebook in your pocket, and you pull it out, and you say, "Hi, I'm writing a story about your town. Can I talk to you for a minute?" 9 out of 10 people will say, "Sure, come on over. Would you like a glass of iced tea? I just pulled a pan of cornbread out of the oven. You know, this is my cousin Sissy. You know, say hello to the man from the Washington Post." 9 out of 10 people do that, and 1 out of 10 people will just drop whatever's in their hands and turn around and take off because they're doing something that they don't want you to find out about and they don't want you to put in the newspaper. But, you know, the waves were breaking my way that day, and everybody I met, you know, was so helpful. And so when I, you know, talked to people about the history and where to eat and, you know, the musical background that's so rich in Macon. And then, you know, when I got around to Little Richard, somebody would say, "Well, you know, you need to talk to Hamp Swain, you know, who was the DJ there, or you need to talk to Newton Collier, who's just the most marvelous man. I'll tell you a little bit more about Newton in a little while." Or finally, somebody said, "Well, you know, Little Richard's cousin lives over here in this housing development." So, you know, I called her up and made an appointment, and she said, "Sure, come on over." So I go over to where Willie Mae Howard lives. That's Richard's slightly older cousin. And I'm sitting there talking to her, and she's very, very happy to tell me about, you know, what he was like as a little boy and how, you know, mainly how kind he was, how thoughtful he was, and how he was always trying to take care of other children and take care of his mother. You know, he had a real affection for his mother. Suddenly the phone rings. She picks it up. And she says, "Yes, yes. Oh, hello, Richard. How are you? Well, I'm talking to a journalist." "Yes, just a minute." And then she looks up at me and she says, "He wants to talk to you." And I said, you know, so my knees are just banging together. You know, never seen or talked to Little Richard before. And, you know, as I said, I've been thinking about this since I was 11 years old, right? I mean, I never in my life thought I would, you know, be writing a book about Little Richard, much less talking to him. So I take the phone and I said, "Hello," and he says, and he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm David Kirby," and I said, "I want to write a book about you." And he said, "What are you doing in my cousin's apartment?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm looking for background. And I'm just talking to different people. She's a very nice lady, and she's very informative." And he says, "Well, look around you." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You can see she's very poor, can't you?" And, you know, she didn't look poor at all to me. I mean, it was a very nicely turned out place. But, you know, who's going to disagree with Little Richard? So I said, "Sure." And he said, "Well, here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to get your checkbook out. I want you to write her a check for $500. And, you know, and, you know, happily, nobody brings, you know, walks around with a checkbook in their pocket. I don't know what I would have done if I'd had it. But, I wanted to keep the conversation going. I wanted to build some goodwill. And I said, the truth is, Mr. Pennyman, I don't have a checkbook with me. He said, but I did go to the cash machine last night, and I got out $100. I said, if it would make you feel better, I'd be very glad to give your cousin that money in compensation for her time and her courtesy. And he said, all right, he said, put her back on. So he puts Willie May back on, and I could hear him. I mean, he didn't really need a telephone. He was shouting so loudly, and he said, the man's going to give you some money. Where's your purse? And she said, what's in the other room? He said, go get your purse. And so she goes, gets some purse, and he comes back, and you can hear him say, got your purse? And she said, got my purse. And he said, get your wallet out. And she gets her wallet out. And he says, get the phone back to the man. So he gets the phone back to me, and he says, okay, get your money out. So I opened my wallet, and I didn't have $100. I had $88 because I'd gotten the money the night before to go to a concert in Megan. I said, Mr. Pennyman, I'm sorry, I only have $88. And he said, that's okay. He said, hand it to my cousin and give her the phone. And I handed it to her cousin. He says, you got the money? She says, I got the money. He said, put it in your wallet. I said, I got it in my wallet. He said, put your wallet in your purse. He said, now take it in the other room. Take it in the room. And then, so she goes back, and it's just like a tennis match, you know, with just wallets and monies and purses and cousins, flying all around the room. And finally he comes back. So I signal that I want the phone, and he says, I did it. And he said, well, thank you. And I said, listen, I do want to follow through with this book. And I said, would you give me your telephone number? I would love to talk to you sometime. He says, I'm not at home right now. I'm in Baltimore. And I said, well, that's okay. And I'll wait until you are home, but I really need to talk to you. And he said, well, I can't do that. He said, I got to get off now. And I said, please click. And I thought that was it. I thought that was it for a while. But anyway, I went back to talking to Willie Mae Howard. We had a great old time, got him hugged. And, I'd put on a sports coat and I brought her some flowers because I didn't want her to think I was just some, parasite. I'm sure she has a lot of contact, as people do, with fans. And so, we had a great old time. And I walked into the parking lot and I thought, did I just give $88 to Little Richard's cousin that I just met and talked to him on the phone? And I said, yeah, I did. So I called everybody I could think of and told them my story.
So that's part of the old weird America coming up right there.
He got me. Yeah. I didn't stand a chance, and I'm so glad I'd not gotten $200 or $300 out of that ATM machine, because I'm sure, Willie Mae Howard would have been licking her thumb and counting up those bills. I spent the rest of my time in Macon, and went home, went back, and wrote my book, which was, well, it's the most fun I've ever had writing anything. If that book disappeared, if somehow all the copies of it in the world disappeared, I would sit down and write it again, because I just had so much fun doing it. But I didn't actually talk to Richard again until after the book was finished. Well, that's not quite right. I did see him. I saw him at a concert, and I went and I talked to him very briefly backstage. But I didn't talk to him on the phone again until after the book had already been published, and someone slipped me, someone whose name may not be mentioned because he's very private about it, someone slipped me his cell phone number, and so I would call him from time to time. I haven't spoken with him recently, and I didn't want to bother him too much. He went through a very painful hip operation, a hip replacement, 2 years ago, and I'm not quite sure if there's any blame to be offered, but I've heard that it didn't go well. that it was botched in some kind of way. And, you know, when you see him on TV in live performances now, and he always comes out in a wheelchair because, you know, it's very hard for him to walk. And then he, you know, he scoots over into his piano, and he's the Little Richard from 50 years ago. But he's a very interesting guy to talk to on the phone because, you know, there are four or five Little Richards, and I never knew which one I was going to get. And sometimes he would say, you know, who are you? Who is this? And I'd say, I'm David Kirby. I'm the guy who wrote the book about you. He said, I don't know anything about any book. And, you know, the way people do when they're in pain. I mean, you know, your mind is just all turned around. And then there would be times when, you know, we'd have long conversations. And that sweet childlike Little Richard that Willie May talked about would come out, and he would, you know, want to know how I was doing, and you know, how things were in Tallahassee, and how my family was. And actually, the last time I talked to him, my mother-in-law had just died. And so we were talking along, and he said, what's going on? And I said, well, my mother-in-law just died. And he said, what was her name? And her name was, her first name was Clarencina. Her father was named Clarence, and she was, you know, they concocted a feminine version of her name. And so I said, her name was Clarencina. And he said, just a minute. And I heard him rustling around. He said, I want to write that down. Spell that for me. And, excuse me, I'm getting a little choked up here, as I always do when I think about this. And I said, C-L, and he said, C-L, and he said, I have some people here with me now. And he said, but when they leave, I will pray for her. And I said, well, you know, thank you. Thank you so much. And, you know, we talked a little bit more, and I hung up. And, you know, I'm not a religious person. I don't go to church or anything that's organized or theistic at all. But, you know, I was just so moved by his, his kindness and his conviction that he could do something for me and do something for my mother-in-law. And then, you know, afterwards I got to thinking, you know, well, what if there were a God and you know, the calls were coming through, you know, and his secretary said, well, you know, Little Richard's on the line. I mean, whose phone call is God going to take? You know, and here's a fourth grader who wants to do, you know, well on his math quiz the next day. And there's a woman who wants to marry her boyfriend, even though she can't stand him. And then there's Little Richard, you know, and God looks up and says, well, I'll take line three. You know, I'll talk to Little Richard, Melissa, or whatever God's secretary's name is.
Well, let's move on to chapter three, which is the chapter about the making of Tutti Frutti. Can you tell us about that chapter and the characters involved, please?
Sure. You know, I always tell my students, because I, you know, I teach writing courses mainly. I always tell my students that art is the deliberate transformed by the accidental. You know, you have to start your process some kind of way. You have to, you know, get up, make coffee or drink a Red Bull or whatever it is, or turn on your computer and get out your paper and your pencil and get organized and then start to work. But then you have to be open to the little accidents that happen. And the story of Tutti Frutti is a long story. I won't tell the whole thing, but it's, you know, it's a classic illustration of that principle, because what happened was Little Richard was touring all over the country. And he did what ambitious artists do, which is he sent a demo tape to everybody he could think of, including a man named Art Roop, who was the head of Specialty Records out in Los Angeles. And the Art's producer was a legendary guy named Bumps Blackwell. And you know, the package arrived, and Art listened to it, didn't think very much of it, and he gave it to the Bumps to listen to, and Bumps said, you know, I think that, as the great producers do, you say, I think there's something here. I think we can work with this guy and bring it out of him. By the way, Bumps said that when the package showed up, it was wrapped in a piece of brown paper that looked as though somebody had eaten off of it. You know, I guess they were fried. There's fried chicken grease or something on there and brown string. And so he opens it up and pulls out this, reel-to-reel tape, plays it, and says, "Let's do something with this." So they contact Richard, and they decide to go to New Orleans, Louisiana, where Fats Domino is already recording. And now Fats Domino has this band that's so tight that when these musicians walk into the studio, you know, the clocks reset themselves to their time. You know, it's not the other way around. So, here's this band that's already, because Bumps hears this voice of Little Richard that's not all that distinctive, not all that great, but he thinks if he marries it to that tight New Orleans sound with the funk and the syncopation in it, you know, he's going to get something out of it. So they get Little Richard in the studio, and Richard is a wild man. You know, he never took music lessons. He bangs on the piano, plays everything in one key. The piano player, a guy named Huey Piano Smith, said, "You know, this guy's terrible. He just can't, he can't play. You know, whatever we do, we can't let him play the piano." And so there they are in the studio, and they were there for 3 days. And the specialty records recording of Richard are available. In fact, it was just remastered and reissued. I just wrote a review of it for a music journal. If any of your listeners want to get it, it's just called Here's Little Richard. It's that first 1957 album. But as with all the albums that come out these days, there are a lot of bonus audio tracks on it. And there's also a very good, very hilarious interview with Art Roop on there. And you can hear some of these early demo versions that Little Richard did, which are really just dismal. But there they are, as Bumps Blackwell said, you know, Richard sounded like Mickey Mouse. He sounded like Mickey Mouse. He didn't sound like the guy that we know today. So, they're practicing and rehearsing and not getting away and taking breaks. Finally, towards the end of the session, they decided to go to a place called the Dewdrop Inn, and Little Richard, who can't stay still to this day for more than 5 seconds, while they're waiting for their food to come, jumps up and goes over to piano and starts singing this vile and scabrous song called Tutti Frutti, which has some sexually charged lyrics to it, and he's banging away and singing and, you know, wagging his behind, and Bumps Blackwell says, that's it, that's what we want, and he says, let's go back and record that, but we can't record those lyrics, but I like the wah ba baloo ma ba la bamboo and the tutti frutti and all this kind of stuff, so we just can't use those lyrics. So meanwhile, around Cosmo Matassa's little studio in New Orleans, and by the way, speaking of the old weird America, Cosmo Matassa owned an appliance store, and like a lot of guys in the 50s owned appliance stores, he ran a line of jukeboxes to local joints, and one day the light bulb came on, and he thought, rather than get these 45 records from somebody else and put them in there, why don't I record my own records? So there, among the waffle irons and the pole lamps, Cosmo Matassa clears out a little space. Talk about the old weird America, right? He clears out a little space and makes a recording studio. It's now a laundromat. It's on the corner of Dauphine and Rampart in New Orleans. But he moves some of the stuff aside and staples some egg cartons to the wall, runs in some lines and sets up some mics, and there they are. And when I mean set up mics, I mean he had three mics, so that the singer would sing, and then if it was time for a sax solo, you know, he would step aside and the saxophone player would step up. The drummer often was out in the hall, because if the drummer was right there in the room, it would overpower everything, so they put the drummer, you know, out in the hall with the mops and the broom. So, you know, so everything was held together by scotch tape and cardboard. So anyway, they rush back to the studio, having heard Little Richard sing Tutti Frutti at the Dewdrop Inn, And there'd been a woman who was hanging around. Her name was Dorothy Labastri, who was a kind of pearl and white glove kind of person. And she'd been hanging around, as people hung around studios in those days, with, you know, trying to get Cosmo Matassa and Bumps and the people to record her songs. And Bumps said, okay, she said, we're going to get Dorothy to write some clean lyrics to this song. Richard, sing the song. And he said, I can't. And he said, why not? He said, I cannot sing that song before this woman. She was actually a teenager. She was maybe 17, 18 years old. And he said, okay, face the wall and sing the song. So Little Richard swings around and faces the wall and sings it. And Dorothy, you know, nods and chews on her pencil and says, give me a couple of minutes. And she goes out and she writes a song that's essentially on the surface about ice cream. You know, it's, you know, the ice cream with the little nuggets of vanilla ice cream with little nuggets of candied red and green fruit in it. And it comes back in. Richard says, I can do this. And, you know, in three takes, they nail the song. And the one you hear on the radio or on, you know, your CD or your iPod, the one you hear today is that third take, which is, you know, it's raw, it's crisp, it sounds as though it was recorded yesterday in a high-tech studio, and it was recorded in this dusty old, you know, dump, you know, next door to, you know, this week's special on the vacuum cleaners. So, you know, you see here, Matt, a real kind of genius on the part of somebody like Bumps. You know, Berry Gordy Jr., who founded Motown Records, was pretty famous for saying, I don't want to make songs for black America. I want to make songs for young America. So he got, you know, a lot of, you know, clever songwriters like Smokey Robinson, and cajole them into writing, essentially, fairly heavy rhythm and blues and funk tunes, but you know, with a lot of the adult stuff just kind of pushed to one side, and an air of innocence, you know, pumped in its place. So when you listen, and of course I didn't think about this when I was 11 years old, but when you listen to Tutti Frutti, which sounds like a 2 minute and 26 second song about ice cream, you know that he's talking about something else. Just the way, you know, when the Beatles sang their songs, you know, the parents thought, well, these guys are nice. You know, look, they have these mop-top haircuts, and they wear, you know, collarless suits. They seem like clean-cut young men. But, you know, the girls knew. You know, there's a savagery and a sexiness underneath that comes through, not in the lyrics, but in the sound.
Even in the suggestiveness of the lyrics, though, of course, right?
Yeah. It's all about appetite. It's all about appetite. The original was a song of no length. It was a club anthem, and Richard would sing it in roadhouses all over the South. And as I talked to Cosmo Matassa, who's now in his 80s, when I was writing the book, and he said, you know, the way it worked was, if you walked in the club and you were wearing a blue suit, you were in the song. You know, see the man with the blue suit on, you know, he can do that thing all night long or something. And so, you know, it was improvisational and raw and endless and just depended on its own bubbly fizziness to carry it along. And Bumps Blackwell said, let me get that, let me cut it, let me clean it up, let me package it, and pow, you get Tutti Frutti.
So, talking about Little Richard a little more broadly and his celebrity, his stardom as a character. One of the things that has to be talked about, I think, is maybe not in his mind, but in everybody else's mind, there's this struggle with, you know, sexuality, with race, with secularism and the sacred. Can you package that all up for us, please?
He was his own worst enemy in a way, because you know, one thing I found as a teacher who teaches people how, you know, how to write poetry. You hear poetry can't be taught. Sure it can. I can teach you how to write a poem in an afternoon. But you have to like to do it. And you know, what it does, the process of composition breaks up a lot of, you know, old-fashioned and staid ideas that you had, and things come tumbling out that you might not be prepared to deal with. And, you know, I think something like that happened to Little Richard. You know, he was unnerved, I think, by his own power. And the songs that we remember him for, songs like Tutti Frutti and True Fine Mama, Ready Teddy, Baby, Slip and Slide, Long Tall Sally, Rip It Up. You know, these are songs that came out in a 2-year period between 1955 and 1957, and that's pretty much it. I mean, he's done, you know, a few things since, but you know, he just, you know, but then what else do you have to do? You know, it's like, did Tolstoy have to write another War and Peace, you know, or did Shakespeare have to write another Macbeth? No. So his handful of work is eternal, you know, it's timeless, but you know, at some point he said, this isn't right. And I think he was, you know, I think he was probably carried away too by the kind of life that he had to live on the road. I mean, this is a profession, in which you drinking is a way of life, drug use and promiscuity are right there with it. And Richard had grown up within the church. His father was a lay preacher, and he did what Jerry Lee Lewis famously did, and a number of other people in those days, which is at one point he said, you know, I can't do this anymore. This is the devil's music, and you know, I've got to turn back to God. The famous story is that he was on tour in Australia, and the Sputnik rocket was sputtering out in the skies above Australia. He looked up and from the concert stage and saw a flaming object course through the air, and he saw that as a sign of God that he should shut up. So he did, and then he's sort of been toggling ever since. When I saw him at this show in St. Augustine, he sang all of his own music. He sang, he sang a lot of tributes. He sang a lot of country and western, because this was something that was big when he was growing up. He sang a lot of Hank Williams songs, for example. But, he sang this bright, savage, sexy music. But when you walked in, there was a little booklet in every seat that was a Come to Jesus tract that would, you know, tell you who to contact and how you could get in touch with, people who would help you to save your soul. And during the concert, you know, he would say, don't put a question mark where God has put a period, and things like this, you know. And he essentially preached. Now, he started out the concert by doing something that none of the rest of us could do. The first thing he did was he banged out a few chords, and he said, I want a big fat white woman to come up on stage and dance. Anybody else, you know, they would have, you know, petitions against them, and, you know, protest marches. But he said, I want a big fat white woman. He said, I want a big fat black woman, and I want a big fat Mexican woman too. You know, he loops all Hispanics into that one category of Mexican women. And, you know, pretty quickly the stage, filled up. I don't know how it broke down ethnically, and I will say that almost all of the women were pretty slender and shapely. But you know, through the magic of rock and roll, as he played, these 20 women or so, they all kind of got plumper and juicier. So you know, he starts out on this carnal note, but then throughout he's talking about God and Jesus. And when I went to see him by the way. He did his Doc Hudson thing. He said, I'll sign posters after the show, but only the big ones, because there was a $5 poster that's about the size of a table mat, and then there was a $20 one that's in the size of a card table. So I went and got a $20 one, and I went back to meet him. And, you know, they're these big, stone-shouldered guards in blue blazers and neckties who talk to you before you go into the room where Little Richard is receiving people, and they say, just get the signature, no talking, don't touching. I said, okay. But, you know, I knew I was going to talk to him, but I knew I had to say something, and I knew I had to say the right thing. Now, Richard, like just about every artist there is not particularly fond of fans, because almost 100% of them are boring. You know, they'll say, oh, I love you, I'm your biggest fan in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. They're either boring or they're psychos, you know, they're stalkers. So I could see why he would have this buffer set up around him to keep the fans away. But, you know, I thought about that. What am I going to say? And then I said, aha. And, you know, I remember when he held me up for $88. And so I just started saying his cousin's name over and over again. And, you know, Willie Mae Howard. So when I finally got to the front of the line, he says, all right, who do I sign this for? And I said, Mr. Pennyman, Willie Mae Howard says hello to you. And he looked up and his eyes got big and he said, you know Bill? Because he called her, not Willie Mae, but Bill. And I said, yes. I said, I was in her apartment when I talked to you 2 years ago. And he said, oh, yeah. I said, I remember talking to you. He said, you gave her some money, didn't you? And I said, yeah, I did, because you shook me down. You know? No, I didn't say that, but I said, yes, sir. I was very happy to do it. So, you know, we talked a little bit, and he said, who should I sign this for? I said, well, sign it for Barbara and David. He said, Barbara, and he writes her name down, David, and underneath it, he writes, God cares, and underlines it, I said, well, thank you. You know, I'm still kind of tongue-tied this one. I said, well, thank you very much. And he sticks his hand out. And so, of course, you know, I automatically reach for him, and the bodyguard says, no touching. And Richard says, it's okay. So he takes my hand, he pumps it, and grabs it with the other hand. And he says, promise me one thing. And I said, I will. What is it? He said, stay close to Jesus. And I said, okay, I will. And he, you know, shook hands I went out and I thought, I'd like to say I'd done a better job of keeping his promise because, if you're going to promise to stay close to Jesus, you know, you could promise it to the guy down the street or the letter carrier or the person who works at the drugstore. But, man, I just promised it to Little Richard Pennyman, you know. So I'm not sure I kept up on my promise there, but, I did get to see that godly side of him that he keeps gravitating back to, but then, it doesn't pay the bills. Until he had this hip operation, he would be on the road until very recently he was doing 200 shows a year, and now it's much fewer. I'm sure it's driving him crazy because, there's nothing like the rush of having an audience go absolutely crazy for you, as they did that night when I saw him perform.
Mm-hmm. So David, how is in all your wisdom is Little Richard Pennyman going to be remembered? Are we going to remember him in 100 years or?
Well, you know, I think we will. He always shows up. You know, music changes. It's always changed rapidly, and the delivery system is so rapid. I mean, when I was a kid, I would, let's just say that music was organized vertically. I mean, you know, you'd look up and above you would be the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the hip kids like Dylan, and the more traditional kids still liked Elvis, and then there were a few others, but everybody sort of looked at these super powers who hung above our heads and worshipped five or six of them. And now music is, you know, it's super horizontal in nature. You know, you can record a song with a computer and you get yourself on YouTube this afternoon. You can make an album, and there's a website called cdbaby.com that will get it out on iTunes for, I think, like $45 or something like that. So the forest is just getting so much bigger. So, you know, it's dependent on guys like you and me, Matt, and people like the ones who published Rolling Stone, and you know, are always having these, you know, the 500 greatest albums. You know, Richard's always at the 500 greatest singers. You know, the 100 greatest pop songs. He's always going to show up there. I mean, Mojo magazine, you know, had a piece a couple of years ago on the 100 greatest songs, and Tutti Frutti was, you know, you work your way through, you know, down through numbers, you know, 3, 2, 1. Tutti Frutti is you know, identified in that magazine as, you know, the greatest pop song of all time. So, you know, I think the historians know what to do and how to get the word out. And, you know, it's no longer common knowledge that, you know, the world is ruled by John Paul George and Ringo, you know, and you know, if I ask 10 students, what, you know, to name 4 bands that they listened to in the last 24 hours, you know, I'll get 40 different bands. So, you know, this is a good thing, by the way. I'm not one of these old guys who's complaining about the new protocols. It's a good thing, but there's a place for Little Richard in there, and I think people will always listen to him, and I'll always see him, and always know how important he was, and how important he is. And he's going to be 80. Happy birthday, Little Richard.
On December 5th, you say?
December 5th, yeah.
Fabulous. Well, David, I want to thank you for writing the book. It was a wonderful read. And I want to thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me on the show. You don't have to thank me for writing the book. It was its own reward, Matt. But it's great talking to music about you, talking about music with you. And I look forward to hearing the playback. Thanks so much. And let me see if I can write another one. We'll talk again.
All right. Thanks, David.
Okay. Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with David Kirby about his book, Little Richard, The Birth of Rock and Roll, published by Continuum in 2009. Check back with New Books in Popular Music regularly for interviews with authors of books about popular music. I'm your host, Matt Smith-Larman. Thanks for listening.